Chapter 26. Have you been in a monastery before? Robert Habeck took Fletch by the elbow and steered him toward a backless bench across the small courtyard. No, Fletch answered. The silence is ear-splitting. I heard the noise of your car. Robert smiled. It seemed an admonition. Fletch and Nancy Habeck Farley had been shown silently into a small, cool waiting room immediately inside the main door. They sat on a carved wooden bench. In a few minutes, the abbot entered. He did not greet them or sit down. Nancy explained she had come to the monastery to tell her brother their father was dead. The abbot nodded and left without uttering a single word. Waiting, Nancy explained to Fletch that this room and the small adjacent high-walled courtyard were the only places females were allowed in the monastery. She had last visited Robert after her first baby was born, almost 7 years ago. Since then, she had written him once a year at Christmas. She had never had an answer from him. They waited a little more than 45 minutes. When Robert entered the room, he smiled and held out his hands to his sister. He did not embrace her or kiss her. He did not say anything. Nancy introduced Fletch as a friend. Looking down at Fletch's shorts, Robert asked, "Are you a Quaker?" "What? No." Robert's ankle-length white robe was belted by a length of black rope. He wore sandals. He was scrawny and balding. His beard looked like it had been struck by a plague of locusts. His eyes went from the dull, inward-directed to a more lively substitute for verbal communication. Following them across the courtyard, Nancy said, "I have 5 children now, Robert. Tom still teaches at the university, but he's becoming quite well known as a poet. Mother is still at the Agnes Whitaker home. Physically, she's quite well. We see her often." Robert sat on the bench and looked up at them with happy eyes. Nancy sat beside him. Fletch sat cross-legged on the ground stone path in front of them. "Robert, I have something difficult to tell you." Contrary to everything she had said, Nancy then began to weep. "Father is dead," she sobbed. "He was murdered, shot to death yesterday in a parking lot." Robert said nothing. His eyes became inward-directed. He did not look at, reach out a hand to, touch his sister in any way. He offered her neither sympathy nor empathy. Desperate to collect herself, Nancy wiped her eyes with the hem of her heavy skirt. Finally, Robert sighed. "So, I don't know what's happening about the funeral," Nancy said. "Jasmine, the partners. Robert, will you come to the funeral?" "No." He put his hand on the bench and looked around the small courtyard as if he wanted to get up and go away. "Here we are used to death. The flowers, the farm animals. It comes to us here. We need not go out to it." Fletch asked, "Do you ever get to leave here?"
"Who would want to?"
"Do you ever leave here?"
"Sometimes I go in the truck to the markets, in the station wagon, to the dentist."
"Do you ever go alone?"
"I am never alone. I carry the Savior with me in my heart."
Nancy put her hand on Robert's hand.
"No matter what we thought of him, Robert, it's a shock. It's hard to take that he was murdered. That someone actually took a gun and ended his life with it. Stood before him, shot him."
"Ah, the great presumption," Robert said, clearly speaking in capitals.
"Why do people keep making the great presumption that we each have the right, moral and legal, to die a natural death, when so many, many of us die by accident, violence, wars, pestilence, famine?"
Nancy glanced at Robert, then looked at Fletch. She moved her hand. "Well," Fletch said, "your father died of violence."
"Murder makes it seem that someone has corrected God," Robert smiled. "We must believe someone has. But no, one cannot really correct that which is perfect."
Nancy straightened the hem of her skirt over her knees with shaking hands. "Robert," Fletch said, "the story is that yesterday morning your father went to the News Tribune to consult with the publisher
John Winters, about the announcement of your father's intention to donate $5 million to the art museum. He had had a meeting at the art museum to discuss this gift. The museum was not sure that it wanted such a gift, as long as your father stipulated that the money be spent exclusively on contemporary religious art. Robert looked interested. Furthermore, Fletch continued, your father told the curator at the museum that he intended to give the rest of his wealth to a monastery, which he intended to enter, to join. At first, Robert raised his eyebrows and stared at Fletch. Then his jaws tightened. He squeezed his eyes shut. Elbows on his knees, hands clutching each other, Robert lowered his head. Nancy and Fletch glanced at each other. Finally, Fletch asked, "Are you angry?" "That man," Robert said through clenched teeth. Fletch asked, "Was he possibly trying to come to you, his son?" Looking at Fletch, Nancy's eyes popped. Robert said, "That man." Fletch asked, "Do you believe any of what I've just told you?" For a long moment, Robert sat on the bench silently, apparently holding himself together with effort. He breathed deeply through his nose. "Impossible," he said. His breathing became easier. "Nancy wrote that my father, after disposing of my mother, institutionalizing her, took a second wife." "Jasmine," Nancy said. Robert's eyes opened. Much of the strain left his face. "I don't suppose she's dead." "No," Nancy answered. "One may not divorce a wife," Robert said, as if elucidating a fine point of law, "for the sake of entering a monastery." Fletch said, "Oh." "So all this is not true," Robert said, "like the rest of my father's life. It is some complicated lie. Even if he were free, months, if not years, of prayerful instruction and reflection would be required." Fletch looked down at the groundstone between his folded legs. He had perhaps more than another $1 million to donate to a monastery. Looking at Fletch, Robert said nothing. Fletch turned the question. "Robert, you must believe in redemption. Is it totally inconceivable to you that your father could make such a change in his life at the age of 60, 61? "My father," Robert said with difficulty, "my father spent his life shortcutting the law. In fact, short-circuiting it. There is no shortcut to eternal paradise. One cannot short-circuit the laws of God." Nancy uttered a short laugh. "Robert, you sound so unforgiving." Finally, Robert turned to his sister. "And are you forgiving?" "No," she said, "not of what he did to mother." "One never knows," Robert said. "Perhaps the man died within the grace of God. I sincerely doubt it." Fletch had the impression Robert did not want his father's company either in the monastery or in paradise. "What he did to mother," Robert said, "what he did to all of us." "What he did to you?" Fletch asked. Robert's eyes became as inflamed as the subjects of an El Greco portrait. "He taught us the one thing that must not be taught to children, that must not be taught society, that one can commit evil with impunity if one lies about it successfully." Robert's voice rose. "And do you expect that a person with such a philosophy, such a practice, can ever come to God?" His voice lowered, but his hands, even his shoulders, shook. "I am spending all my adult life trying to separate myself from such a wicked belief. It is the one belief which can destroy society. It is the one belief which can corrupt irretrievably a person's soul." Trying to smile at Fletch, Robert asked, "And do you believe a person with such a mindset could confess with honesty and come to God?" Fletch felt he ought not answer. Robert modulated his voice. "What he did to us that is unforgivable is that he corrupted us beyond belief." Fletch stood up from the groundstone path. Robert spoke, looking at his calloused fingers. "It doesn't matter who killed him. We are all murdered by life, by our own way of life, by how we live. Of course he died a violent death. His life condoned, encouraged violence. We are all victims of ourselves." Nancy was standing up too. "All that matters is that he died in God's grace. although I can't believe he did and is condemned to suffer in hell through all eternity, we will not know. Such was his life, such was his death. All between his divine creator and himself. Despite the circumstances, Nancy said, straightening her skirt, it's good seeing you, Robert. Robert did not rise from the bench. Robert did not answer. Right, Fletch said. Try to get some peace. Between the waiting room and the monastery's main door, Fletch said to Nancy, wait one moment for me, will you? He crossed the foyer and entered a small outer office lined with filing cabinets. He then went through an open door into a larger, well-furnished office where the abbot sat behind a large wooden desk. The abbot looked up from some eye-saving pale green papers on his desk. Pardon the intrusion, Fletch said. The abbot didn't say he did or didn't pardon the intrusion. Robert's father, Donald Habeck, not only died yesterday, he was murdered. There was no response apparent from the abbot. It is important for us to know if Donald Habeck came and talked with you recently. The abbot pondered as if this might be a trick question from the body of scholastic philosophy. Yes, the abbot finally said slowly. Donald Habeck came to see me recently. Yes, we talked. More than once? The abbot looked at the open door behind Fletch. When he came to see you, Fletch asked, did he also see Robert? To my best knowledge, Robert did not know he was here, the abbot answered. Was Robert here yesterday morning? Monday morning? I expect so. May I ask the nature of your conversation with Donald Habeck? No. You can be subpoenaed, Fletch said. You have my address, the abbot answered. I am always here. Nancy awaited Fletch in the car. Before Fletch had the key in the ignition, she said, I need a beer break. The odor of sanctity makes me want to puke. Chapter 27. Cecilia's Boutique, Cecilia speaking. Have you considered jodhpurs? Good afternoon, Fletch said. I ordered a pair of jodhpurs for my wife this morning, a color you don't have in stock. There's a color we don't have in stock? Special order. Green, white, and black stripes, vertical at the thighs and calves, horizontal at the knees. We certainly don't have that in stock. It's all right, I understand. You're a small shop. Can't have all the jodhpurs in the world in stock. I thought we did, Cecilia said beguilingly. I told the sales girl, who said her name was Barbara, that I'd call her this afternoon with my wife's exact size. That would be Barbara Ralton. May I speak with her, please? Of course. After a pause, Barbara said, Hello? Hiya, sweetie. Fletch, how did you get through to me? I lied, but it's all right. I can forgive myself. When people are corrupt enough to oblige lies, I oblige them. Where are you? In the only bar in Tomasito. Tomasito, what are you doing there? Having a lukewarm beer. You went a long way for a beer. Listen, Barbara, I won't be able to have dinner with you and your mother tonight. There are things I still have to do. You promised. I promised for tomorrow night. That will leave only 2 days till the wedding. Absolute promise. Fletch, did you hear on the radio that the police released the man who confessed to Habeck's murder?
Yes.
Oh, no, that's why you're in Tomasito. That's why you're going to be late tonight. The week we get married, you are determined to get yourself fired over that Habeck story.
Barbara, I had another assignment from the News Tribune, but you know, somehow or other, the rug got pulled out from under my feet on it.
The travel story? What has Cindy got to do with a travel story?
You can go a long way with Cindy. How did she like the ski outfit?
She liked it. I bought it. Cindy has excellent taste in sportswear.
I'll say. Barbara, do you have any idea what Cindy does for a living?
Yeah, she works for one of those diet health spas, which is why I was so surprised to see she had a banana split for lunch. I guess she can take such a thing, but she sets people like me a real bad example.
She works it off, I guess, one way or another.
I forget which spa she works for. One of the fancy ones downtown, I think.
Do you think she might be gay?
Cindy? Lesbian? No way. I've seen her out with lots of men.
I'm sure you have.
Cindy's real nice.
Yes, she is. See you tonight. You are coming to the beach house?
Absolutely.
I'll just be late. You might put some curtains up in the bedroom. Don't you like getting it up early?
Not that early.
Chapter 28. Hey! Damn it all, open up!
Again, Fletch pounded on the door. Again, he looked to the street corner. Again, he tried the doorknob. Again, he read the sign, emergency egress only. Main entrance around corner, Agnes Whitaker home. He was about to sprint again. He banged the door one more time with his fist.
Hey!
It opened. Inside, on the cement floor, were green sneakers.
I saw you through the window, Mrs. Habeck said. You'd better come in.
Fletch entered quickly and closed the door behind him.
Why was that policeman chasing you? Mrs. Habeck asked.
Damned if I know, Fletch breathed deeply. Just after I parked about 5 blocks from here, this cop jumped out of his car, yelled at me, and started chasing me. His partner got stuck in traffic. Thanks for letting me in.
You certainly had a good lead on him, Mrs. Habeck said admiringly. Of course you're dressed for running. If it's the police's job to catch people, why don't they wear shorts and sneakers, too?
In the utility hall where they stood, her flower dress seemed particularly bright. Fletch said,
I don't know your first name.
Why should you?
Mrs. Habeck turned and led him through a door and along a corridor.
I've been awaiting you, you see. But now you're late. They'll be setting supper for us soon. A ridiculously early hour, I know, but as you know, institutions set out their 3 meals within the same 8-hour workday. As a result, some institutionalized people are too fat, some are too thin. None can outrun a policeman, I'm sure.
They went into a large room at the front of the building. A television at the back of the room played a quiz game show for 3 depressed-looking people. A man in a full suit sat at a bridge table, mulling over a hand of cards. The 3 empty positions at the table had cards neatly stacked in front of them. At the side of the room, a young woman in jeans and a T-shirt that said Property ICU Athletic Department worked a computer terminal. Fletch and Mrs. Habeck sat in chairs in a front corner of the room. She had an excellent view of the street from her window.
My name is Louise, she said.
Is that what your friends call you?
Don't have any friends, Louise Habeck said. Never have since I was married. My husband's friends genuinely didn't like us, you see. None of our friends did. Your shorts ask if I want a friend. Well, I did want a friend at one time. It's like wanting a cup of tea in a desert. I'm sure you know what that's like. After a while of not having a cup of tea, it becomes all right. You stop wanting it.
She lifted a large brown paper shopping bag from the floor beside her chair and put it in Fletch's lap.
I've been nothing less nor more than Mrs. Habeck for a good long time now.
In the bag, neatly folded, were his jeans, T-shirt, undershorts, and socks. They smelled clean. At the bottom of the bag, he could feel his sneakers.
You did wash my clothes for me.
I said I would.
My favorite sneakers.
My, they made an amusing noise going round in the dryer. The noise a camel might make after having been trained for an Olympic track event. He changed from his new white sneakers to his old dirty holy sneakers. She watched him wriggle his toes in them.
You might have been able to run away from the policeman even faster if you'd been wearing those.
Outside the window, the policeman stood, arms akimbo, on the curb.
My husband, of course, always wore black shoes. Somehow or other, he always managed to wander away in black shoes.
They watched the police car come down the street, make a U-turn, and pick up the policeman.
I honestly don't know what the policeman's chasing me was all about, Fletch said.
Maybe I should have stopped and asked, but there's a lot I want to do yet today.
I love the way you arrive places, she said. Yesterday, reeking of bourbon. Today, chased by a cop. Reminds me of no one whatsoever.
You depart places pretty well. He remembered her disappearing yesterday with his clothes.
Oh, yes, she agreed. Once you're put out of your own home because you're too much trouble, after that, you know, departing anywhere becomes easy, like not wanting a cup of tea.
Tea, he said, yes.
Sorry I can't offer you any, she said. All these people around here dressed in white are not paid to fetch and carry. A large man dressed in white was now standing just inside the recreation room door. They make that quite clear when you first arrive. They're paid to stand around like dolts and grimace. She grimaced at the large dolt. He didn't see her. His eyes were totally bloodshot. "Scat," she said to him. "Go set supper." The well-dressed bridge player put down his hand, took the seat to his left, and picked up that hand. "I'll be a cup of tea," Fletch said. She smiled and nodded with understanding. "Tell me," Fletch said gently, "do you know by now your ex-husband is dead?" She laughed. She slapped her knee. "That would make him ex enough. Expired." Again in her presence, Fletch did not know if he ought laugh. He cleared his throat. "I've spent today visiting your family." "You're trying to discover who done Donald in," she said gleefully. "Well, I'm trying to get the story, trying to understand." "There's no understanding Donald. Never was. If he himself told me he was dead, I'd wait for the obituary before believing it." "Obituaries," Fletch said solemnly, "are not always to be believed either." "I hope they had some source for the news of his death other than himself or his office." "Oh, they did. He was shot to death in the parking lot of one of the newspapers." "He must have a jury deliberating somewhere."
"What do you mean?"
"Donald always calls attention to himself when he knows a jury is going to bring in a positive verdict. He says it's good for business."
"He didn't shoot himself," Fletch said. "The gun wasn't found."
"It wandered away," she said. "Wandered away on black shoes."
"Yes, okay. Tell me, do you often go back to your old house and sit in the garden? The gardener didn't know you."
"Not often. Usually I don't sit there unless I know no one's there. I'm used to that house being empty, you know. Sometimes Jasmine surprises me. She comes out of the house and sits with me and we talk. She's discovered living with Donald is lonelier than living alone. He wanders away, you know."
"On black shoes. What was special about yesterday?"
"Yesterday? Let me think. Oh, yes. Donald got shot."
"I mean, you stayed at the house even though the gardener was there."
"Such a nice day."
"When I met you yesterday, did you know Donald had been killed?"
"I knew it sometime. I don't know whether I knew it before or after meeting you. Meeting you didn't seem that significant originally. You weren't drunk, were you?"
"No."
"You smelled it."
"Did you know before I told you that Donald intended to announce that he was giving $5 million to the museum?"
"I washed your clothes for you. Bumpity bumpity bump went the sneakers in the dryer, exactly like a camel running the 440.
The bridge player was now in the fourth position at the table. "How do you get around, anyway?"
"Vaguely."
"I mean, how do you get around the city? To your daughter's house, to..."
"I sit in an open, empty car. When the driver comes back from shopping or whatever, I tell him or her where I want to go. They take me."
"Always?"
"Always. I'm a little old blue-haired lady in a bright dress and green sneakers. Why wouldn't they? Sometimes they have to go someplace else first. I go, too. The secret is that I'm never in a hurry. And," she noted, "sometimes I get to see places I wouldn't otherwise see."
Fletch frowned.
"Your daughter did somewhat the same thing this afternoon."
"Did she?
I never explained to her how I do it. She never asked. But poor dear, she hasn't any money either. I went with your daughter to the monastery of St. Thomas this afternoon and spoke with Robert."
"That sinner."
"Why do you say that?"
"Have you ever heard of the sin of omission?"
"No."
"Robert's omitting life in that monastery. I suspect he'd rather be in jail, but he knew his father would prevent his going to jail no matter what he did. I think some people want to be in jail, don't you?"
"Shooting his father would accomplish two goals, wouldn't it?"
"Splendidly."
"I think I heard your son, the monk, actually saying something like he doesn't much care if his father goes to hell."
"Oh, we all felt that way about Donald, didn't you?"
"Didn't know him."
"Not a pity. When Nancy was telling Donald their father was dead, she wept."
"Nancy,
I brought her up to be such a pretty girl, and for a while there she was such a whore.
Was she?
She married her college professor, you know, what's his name?
Tom Farley.
Yesterday you didn't know his name, today you do. You see, you've learned something.
Not much.
I try to get his name around in my own small way.
Rather a strange man, don't you think?
Oh, he's a darling, very good to me. He publishes my poetry.
What?
Well, he gets it published, under his own name, of course.
Fletch sat forward.
What? Well, you just indicated you wanted to learn something.
What are you saying?
That little book, The Knife, The Blood, those are my poems.
Fletch stared at the blue-haired lady in the corner of the Agnes Whittaker home's recreation room. You do like playing with words.
Very much, she said firmly, very much.
Expired husband, with sounds, hey, ha, haw.
They're good poems, aren't they?
I think I believe you.
The poetry of violence written by... The few critics who reviewed the poems referred to them as that.
Poetry of violence?
Oh, I suppose so. Poetry of truth and beauty. I don't like labels.
Your writing these poems changes the meaning of them altogether.
Does it?
It shouldn't.
It changes the perspective. The sidewalks of the city offer up without pity old ladies to be mugged.
If you think a young man wrote that, it seems cruel, but if you know a 60-year-old woman wrote it...
I don't know about criticism. I know Tom needed to publish something to keep himself employed at that university. His own poems wander around on black shoes like Donald. Never can get a hold of them.
So verbose they should be verboten.
Well, they are forbidden, essentially. Couldn't get them published. So I gave him mine. He has my 5 grandchildren to support.
My God, life is crazy.
Interesting thought.
Tom talks as if he wrote those poems.
He's supposed to. It's a secret, you see. Even Nancy doesn't know. You mentioned perspective. Who'd publish the poems of a little old lady in a private mental home? Tom is a university professor. If he presents something to a publisher, at least it will be read, right? I can't help it if the world's perspective is crazy.
When people are corrupt enough to oblige lies, you oblige them.
Tom's working on the 2nd volume now. I'm helping him. It's very difficult for him, you see. When a person has to lecture almost every day in 50-minute lumps, it must be nearly impossible for him to think in terms of a simple, concise line, each word pulling more than its own weight, a cadence that works in the briefest moment. Don't you think?
I have no idea.
But you see, I, on the other hand, have lived more or less in silence. A silence so profound that when a sound, a word, emerges into it, I realize it in the most complete sense. Hear it, feel it, touch it, taste it, turn it over and over in its isolation, in my isolation. Sound to Tom in his busy life with 5 children must be resisted somewhat. Sound to me is cherished, and I coax it into fullness, into meaning.
Explored, exploited, explained, exploded, Fletch said. Expired.